Hello everyone, welcome back to Rai Affairs. My name is Nicola, and as always I'll be your host for this episode. As you know, RAIA is a youth-led international think tank that translates the abstract world of international affairs by simplifying rather than generalizing. RAIA is a place where you come to learn about the stories and worries of political leaders, the behind-the-scenes of decision-makers, and how politics impacts and changes your life. This is RAIA Affairs, filling you in wherever you are. We start with a disclaimer that expressed opinion in this episode are welcome, even though they are not a direct reflection of RAIA, as we specialize in unbiased writing. This episode is the second in a series of six as part of the IE RAIA Summer Research Program of 2025. RAIA has invited 12 IE university students to join our think tank and spend 9 weeks researching a figure from around the world to try to answer a simple question. Are they a climate leader? During their research, students have done a deep dive of the person's background, policies, and the impact of said policies in an effort to bring light to the diverse ways in which every person, no matter the role that they play in society, can contribute to the global climate change policy framework. In today's episode, we will be focusing on Anne Hidalgo, Mayor of Paris. And here with us, we have Alice Girotto and Brian Thorne. Welcome to RAIA Affairs, guys. Thank you very much for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you here. Would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Hi, my name is Alice, and I'm a first-year international relations student, and I'm going to start my second year.
Hello, my name is Brian. I'm entering to my third year of international relations and business administration, and yeah, looking forward to this.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction, guys. Obviously, I mispronounced Alice's name because as an Italian, I pronounced it Alice, but she actually told me before that that's fine. She accepts all pronunciation of her name. And again, thank you very much for being here. So before we start, I'll ask you to answer our usual ice-breaking question. This is a question that we ask every guest on the podcast. So could you tell us which leader, either dead or alive, who has impacted the world would you want to have a conversation with and why?
I think I would like to have a conversation with Otto von Bismarck, the chancellor of the reunified Germany in 1870. I think someone like Bismarck had a mind like no one else, as he completely built a strategic way of reunifying Germany, of course, maybe not in the best way in many wars. However, he was the pioneer of realpolitik, which is something that I've been interested in for a long time. And I would love to understand his power-centric view of how he was able to unite two opposing sides in Austro-Hungarian and the Russian Empire to make an alliance in the Three Emperor League.
And I would choose Antonio Guterres, the current Secretary General of the United Nations and also the former Prime Minister of Portugal, because he's been an important advocate for climate action and also human rights. And I would love to have a conversation with him on how the UN is holding a country accountable to their climate commitments. Especially now, as so many countries are falling short of their Paris Agreement targets, how in the future the UN could hold accountable countries for their actions.
Great, guys. I loved the picks. Kind of like opposite picks. We have Otto von Bismarck on one side, as Brian perfectly explained, kind of like this realpolitik, really like realism in international politics. And on the other side, Antonio Guterres, you know, UN, human rights, etc. I really love the picks, especially Bismarck. I would say I would have loved, I'm a big fan of realpolitik myself. I would have loved to have a conversation with him. And I'm also super interested in that particular period of history where we have obviously the German unification, but 10 years before, there was also the Italian unification. So is especially interesting to me. So thank you very much, guys. And now I would say that we can start our conversation about your report on Anne Hidalgo. And as always, we start with an overview of the person's history and especially of the person's characterization as a climate leader. So in the introduction of your report, you describe Anne Hidalgo not just as the mayor of Paris, but as a key actor on the international climate stage. So could you please give us a summary of her history and what do you think makes her climate approach so unique, not just in terms of her policies, but also in how she has chosen to frame climate action as part of her political mission?
Yes, so Anne Hidalgo was born in the region of Cadiz in the south of Spain, and she moved at the age of 2 years old, in Lyon with her family to escape the economic crisis in Spain at the time. She grew up in a modest background, and later in university she went on to study social studies, and she first started her career also as a labor inspector, and her childhood and early career really defined her socialist views and how she carried out her policies then to this day, and also explain why she targets social mobility and also development in her policies. In 1994, she joined the Socialist Party and became advisor to the former Prime Minister Lionel Jospin, and where she promoted equality, particularly gender equality. In 2014, she was then elected mayor of Paris, becoming also the first woman mayor of the city. And she continued also her predecessor's work in climate action, in clearing the streets of traffic, but also implementing more cycling lanes to reduce air pollution. She then ran also in 2022 for the presidential elections, but she lost in the first round. In Paris, she's recognized for her green policies, but she's also heavily criticized by Parisians for disruptions caused by urban planning modifications, and also, but she believes that accepting these inconveniences is a necessary thing to combat global warming.
Well, in the report, you explain how Paris has been experiencing a steady rise in average temperatures. And this seems one of the big problems that Anne Hidalgo's administration had to face. So I wanted to ask you, how has this rise exposed the vulnerability of the city? And do you think that rising temperatures are actually the main problem that Hidalgo's environmental agenda aims to address, or at least the most urgent one?
Well, we're already looking at a Paris that has warmed by 2.3 degrees Celsius compared to pre-industrial times, surpassing a ceiling that had been placed at 2 degrees Celsius by the Paris Agreement. I mean, already this has pushed several organizations like the IPCC to forecast worst-case scenarios in Paris in which temperatures could rise from 4.5 to 5 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. We're talking about a massive increase in temperature despite seeming like nothing. Following current trends, it's been estimated that 16% there will be a 60% increase in evaporation of the Seine River by 2050 and a 10% decrease in water recharge by the end of the decade. We're looking at a massive decrease in the water supply affecting not only Paris, but the whole region of Paris. But on top of that, we're also looking at health concerns as rising temperature lead to higher heat stress and even heat strokes, which is especially dangerous to vulnerable groups, but I will get into that. Other health concerns, for example, from constant sweating stresses both the heart by making it beat faster as it pumps blood to the skin to dissipate heat, and the kidneys as the sweating causes a reduction of water, which leads to dehydration and poor filtering ability of the kidney. So in concerns with her agenda, in an interview in 2023 she did with Le Journal du Dimanche, she mentioned that she was focused on protecting the most vulnerable groups, including children, the elderly people, homeless people, and migrants. This is important because, especially for elderly people, because we are seeing that the amount of elderly people will increase in a 1-to-4 ratio. So every one inhabitant, there will be 4 elderly people per one inhabitant by 2040, which is extremely close. And we've seen in a study that it is especially affecting those elderly people who are 65 years or older, which is going to be most of the population of Paris. And she has stressed this in the Paris Climate Action Plan for the period 2024-2030. And additionally, she's mentioned that she, as part of the Paris Climate Action Plan, she wants to address fairness across all groups, focusing mainly on vulnerable groups. And overall, in all her policies, she's not only mitigating climate change, but she's preparing Paris for increasingly hotter days and hotter summers.
Well, another issue that you explore in the report is Paris' carbon footprint. How is the situation looking right now regarding CO2 emissions? And how do you assess Hidalgo's response to this emission crisis? Do you think she's managed to address the systemic sources of emissions?
I mean, the picture is looking brighter, definitely, I would say. Compared to 2004, Paris has seen massive improvements. In 2021, the Paris Center recorded 4.78 million tons of CO2 carbon dioxide equivalent in these three greenhouse gases, in carbon dioxide, methane, and carbon monoxide, which has decreased massively compared to 2004, which was around more than 20 million tons. In 2022, the carbon footprint was 9.3 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent, and local emissions were down to 4.72 million tons of CO2 equivalent. Overall, it's looking very good. However, still current trends are leading forecasts to project a 3.5 degrees Celsius average temperature increase by the end of the decade, which is alarming, as this is due to many pollutants such as nitrogen dioxide, particulate matter 2.5, and ozone still remaining high, and also CO2. And this is especially alarming, as this can affect the health of Parisians. And all of this is caused due to the high population density, especially from the combustion engine vehicles, heating systems, and the construction. I mean, already in 2023, 7,900 avoidable deaths could have been avoided annually in the Paris region. And more than 2,000 Parisians were affected by nitrogen dioxide exceeding threshold levels. And to address, if she has addressed the systemic sources of emissions, I believe she has, with several reforms, for example, the transformation reforms and the CFEs. She has been able to put out of circulations highly polluting vehicles. In urban planning, she has introduced a bioclimatic urban land use plan, which is aiming to phase out concrete and decrease the carbon footprint of buildings, as well as the Eco-Renovance, which is focusing especially on private housing in energy-efficient renovations.
You also write that floods and heat waves, but more in general, extreme weather events, have become a real threat to Parisian life, affecting especially vulnerable populations like the elderly and those who live alone. Is the situation really that serious? And in what ways has Hidalgo tried or failed to address the climate resilience of the city?
Yes, the situation is vital. We're looking at an increase in heat waves already, not only in Paris and in France, but in all throughout the Northern Hemisphere. In 2003, in the heat wave, 14,000 deaths were recorded nationally in France, and with many occurring in Paris, the concentration of these fatalities. And this is especially alarming, like I mentioned, is especially crucial for elderly people, who several of them can be left isolated without any help or rapid response, which can lead to their increased mortality. And this is important as well, as since many, many buildings are poorly insulated, those who live on top floors are severely affected, as temperatures on roofs can reach 80 degrees Celsius, worsening the living conditions for those living on top floors. In the matter of floods, already we're seeing an increase in the risk of 100-year floods, which is expected to increase to 20% by the end of the decade, which is not only on 100-year floods, but decennial floods, which decennial floods are likely to happen every 10 years. And the impact of a 100-year flood could destroy massive amounts of city infrastructure, especially about electricity and water supply, focused on not only on sewage system, but also on the potable water. So we're talking about something complete, a matter that is very pertinent to the climate action call.
Well, sorry, Brian.
Just to address the last question. She, once again, as I already mentioned, she's made some efforts in relation to decrease the sources of climate change, especially around global warming, which is what's pushing increasing rainfall patterns, which is increasing the level of floods, and also living conditions in, for example, in a 1,000 anti-heating roofs program to increase the habitability of top floors.
Well, that really seems like a big problem, and definitely it is part of the Hidalgo's environmental agenda. And now I would like to move to a different topic, because in the report you identified the COP21, which was held in Paris in 2015, as Anne Hidalgo's defining moment, particularly her role in bringing together mayors from around the world together through the climate summit for local leaders. So I wanted to ask you, what made her leadership during COP21 so significant, not just for Paris, but for urban climate policy more broadly? And how do you think that this moment helped elevate her role and the role of cities and city leaders in global climate governance?
So COP21 for Anne Hidalgo was a very important moment for her, but not just for her political career, but also how she advocated that cities should be recognized as a part of the global climate conversation. While world leaders and national governments were negotiating the terms for the Paris Agreement, Hidalgo was focused on local governments, because she saw that cities were the front line of climate change, because they produced for over 70% of global emissions, making them a crucial part of climate action, but also they're the most vulnerable ones. For her, it only made sense that climate action should start from the bottom, from cities, rather than from a more international level. So together with Michael Bloomberg, Hidalgo co-organized the Climate Summit for Local Leaders, an event which happened at the same time as the COP21, and together they brought over 1,000 mayors to discuss climate action. And this gathering was not only symbolic, but it was also very important in discussing collaborations between cities and possible climate solutions. And what made this event so significant was that it created a space for mayors to collaborate and to learn from one another, and also to commit to reducing urban carbon footprint on a local level. And the summit really reinforced that idea that cities are not just implementing climate policies, but they're the ones that also should be innovating them. And for Hidalgo, the summit also marked her evolution for someone advocating for the importance of local leadership to someone actually that is convening it. So this moment didn't only elevate her, but it also gave importance to all of the major cities in their role against climate change.
Great. And now we can move on to kind of analyze the different policies that Hidalgo's administration have put into place to tackle these climate change related problems. And the first policy that you analyze in the report is the so-called Zone à Faible Émission, which is basically a low emission zone initiative, from my understanding. You discuss how it has basically restricted polluting vehicles from Paris. Could you explain more precisely what this policy is about, how it has changed daily life in Paris, and how it has been received both by the public and by the political opposition?
Yes, so ZFEs are a policy designed to reduce air pollution, especially by restricting the most polluting vehicles from entering Paris. And it was first introduced on a national level. It was part of Emmanuel Macron's plan during his first term as president. But Anne Hidalgo was one of the first ones to implement it, and Paris was the first city to have it up and running. So this policy focuses on transport, because 66% of nitrogen dioxide emissions, and also more than half of PM10 and PM25 emissions, which are particulates that are very toxic, are associated to transportation. And this policy relies on the Critère sticker system, which divides vehicles into six categories. Zero being the cleanest and five being the most polluting. And it bans gradually the vehicles from the Paris area. The goal of this policy is to reduce all of the harmful pollutants that I've mentioned before, and that are linked to diseases such as asthma, heart diseases, also premature death. The issue is especially tied to diesel vehicles. In 2015, a transport-related pollution was linked to 11 deaths per 100,000 residents in Paris. Since their implementation, the ZFEs have proven to be very efficient, especially in dropping the nitrogen dioxide emissions, which have dropped by 87% since 2016, which is huge. And the policy has also accelerated a shift towards cleaner transport, which is also supported by Hidalgo's cycling plan, which was installed in 2015. And the timeline for this policy is to completely phase out diesel vehicles by 2024 and petrol vehicles by 2030. The problem with this policy is on a social level. So it's been very criticized by Parisians because it has a very high impact on lower income residents that often struggle to afford cleaner vehicles. Some Parisians see this policy as green luxury, and since you need to have the financial means to be able to switch from one mode of vehicle of transportation to another, and be able to afford more sustainable transportation. So politically, it faced criticism from both the left and the right for being socially inequitable. And in June 2025, the National Assembly voted to completely scrap out DFEs nationally, but Hidalgo plans on continuing to expand DFEs in Paris and also tighten the restrictions of the low emissions areas.
Yes, and that seems like a problem that many leaders have faced when we talk about climate action, because on one side you have the environmental needs, the need to approach the problems that we've talked about, which are heat waves, extreme weather events like floods and heat waves, as we said before, but also rising temperatures. And on the other side, you have the social impact of these policies, which are often a problem, like for example, like you explained right now with the zone à faible émission and the effect that it can have on normal citizens who use their cars every day in their daily life. So that is definitely something that we need to take into the picture when we talk about climate action. And another policy implemented by Hidalgo's administration is the Bioclimatic Urban Land Use Plan. And the plan is described as a strategic framework that oversees the central planning and regulation of upcoming construction, renovation, and rehabilitation of buildings in the city of Paris. Its main aim is to match urban development with climate resilience. Could you explain to our audience what this means in practice? Because it sounds really like as a rhetorical way of putting things, but at the end of the day, could you explain what it means in practice and what does the plan actually entail and what about the implementation? Is it working or is it struggling?
Okay, so in practice, it basically means that it is a rule, in a way, it's like a rule book of the way that buildings can be renovated and for the amount of constructions that will happen in the city for the urban development of Paris. Essentially, it's putting the rules and the do's and the don'ts. What's happening is that in the bioclimatic PLU, or the Urban Land Use Plan, we're seeing that Anne Hidalgo is focusing on decreasing the amount of demolitions, but also decreasing the carbon footprint of construction work sites, as construction work sites can contribute a lot to the energy consumption, to the increase of the emission of carbon dioxide, as this whole process of construction needs energy to supply several remote engines. For also, it needs trucks, it needs high working machinery, which transports a lot of CO2 emissions with it, and it's focused around that. The plan is putting, like I said, rules for demolitions, and it's limiting demolition and for construction worksite, but it's also mandating for the use of low carbon and biosource materials, for example, wood, hemp, cut stone, raw earth, all over concrete, in its plan to completely phase out concrete due to its poor insulation, its high CO2 carbon footprint, and its high heat retention properties. Not only that, but she's focusing on building components, is focusing on the amount that of carbon emissions that these building components can contribute to per meter squared. For housing, it's looking at 580 kilograms of CO2 equivalent per meter square, and for offices, as this is for buildings in general, so we're also looking at offices as well, it's looking at 710 kilograms of CO2 equivalent per meter squared. Now, like I mentioned previously, it's also looking at remodeling and renovating roofs, as top floors are completely affected. However, also roofs have the potential for energy production with solar panels. So she's looking at this 1,000 anti-heating roofs initiatives, focusing on zinc roofs, as these roofs are part of, I think it's part of more than half of the building fleet in Paris. So she's looking to completely renovate the buildings to make top floors more habitable. And also she's repurposing roofs to include vegetation, solar panels, urban gardens, or rainwater systems that can help redistribute the heat and boost resilience of buildings. Now, in the implementation part, since it's such a relatively new policy, it was launched last year in 2024, we have not seen yet the fruition of results. However, we are seeing the works and developments of projects called SACs, or concerted development zones. These are basically lands that are under the direct intervention of the public authority, like the city, to develop and equip the land for a subsequent sale to either public or private users. Essentially, the city is implementing the whole bioclimatic plan, PLU, in these SACs. As they lead the projects, they construct, they lead the whole construction of the project, the development, the review, and they apply all the rules. For example, one of them is the Chapelle Charbon, one in the 18th arrondissement, and already it's planning to, for its district heating, to come from 50% renewable energy. Already, heating is one of the main problems in housing that produces the most CO2 emissions. And also, by using biosourced resources for this SAC, it's going to decrease the carbon footprint by 38% compared if it was using the 2012 regulations. Additionally, Paris is investing massive, it's allocating massive amounts of funds for this plan. So it is looking bright in the future.
Well, in your report, you also mentioned the Éco-Rénovant Paris Plus initiative, a program that has been in operation now for 9 years, having been launched for the first time in 2016. And the plan is basically an encouragement program for the private housing sector to engage in energy efficient renovations. So what is the idea behind it, and what kind of impact is the program actually having?
So the Éco-Rénovant Paris Plus policy, the idea behind it is pretty simple. It's looking at changing the whole private housing and co-jointly households, changing the whole fleet to make it more energy efficient. The plan, this policy is focused on meeting the goals of the Paris Climate Action Plan for the 2024-2030 period, which is looking at not only reducing the local emissions and carbon footprint of Paris, but it's targeting decrease the energy consumption overall and adding on renewable energy. So since 2016, the Éco-Rénovant Paris Plus policy has been doing massive amount of works. Already, let me just say, buildings represent 25% of Paris CO2 emissions, which is really important, and it's one of the bigger contributors to the carbon footprint of the city. And Paris has a massive stock of buildings that are poorly insulated and energy intensive. So this plan targets directly this part, this sector. So the policy provides financial aid and technical support, and it can cover about financial aid. It can cover up to 70% of the renovation costs for low income households. It can help. It can exempt those households who are looking to renovate and to make energy efficient renovations. They can exempt them from property tax for up to 3 years, which is an incredible incentive already. As of 2023, since its launch, we have seen 44,534 private households, almost 750 jointly owned properties, and almost 14,500 housing units overall been renovated under the Éco-Rénovant Paris Plus policy, which, thanks to these renovations, the average energy saving per household has been 57%. This is massive for people, especially those living in precarious situations. And these efforts has helped decrease Paris' footprint from 28.3 million tons in 2004 to 4.72 million tons of CO2 equivalent in 2022. And this is local emissions only. And financially, the city of Paris is allocating massive amount of funds for buildings, looking at 13 million for privately owned and 10 million for co-joint household. This is the level of impact that the Éco-Rénovant Paris Plus policy is having.
Well, this it seems like a policy that is already showing its results, and it seems like really a massive impact, as Brian explained. And this brings us almost to the end of the episode. I have one last question to ask you. And as always, it's a question about the bigger picture, because you've spent 9 weeks researching Anne Hidalgo, her background, her ideas, her leadership. So I would like to ask you, after all that, in your own words, do you believe Anne Hidalgo is in fact a climate leader? And also, what can other cities and leaders around the world learn from the way she has approached urban climate policy?
Yes, so Brian and I definitely believe that Anne Hidalgo is a climate leader, because she managed to switch the focus from a more global leadership to local leadership for climate action, and really promote a systemic change, especially with her, all of her urban planning projects. And for what other leaders can learn from her, first is definitely empower cities, because as said before, local leaders are essential actors, and they're not just policy implementers. Cities also need to innovate and find ways to protect their citizens, as in Anne Hidalgo, as Anne Hidalgo did with all of her urban planning projects, and also the DFEs. Then to also think holistically. So Anne Hidalgo's predecessor, and the former mayor of Paris before her, focused on reducing air pollution by reducing congestion, traffic congestion in the streets of Paris, and also implementing more bike lanes. So Anne Hidalgo continued these policies, but then she also implemented more urban planning projects to have a more holistic approach on the issue. And then another key takeaway for other leaders that want to take example on her and also is also to collaborate globally. So through the Climate Summit for Local Leaders held during the COP21, Anne Hidalgo managed to build a network amongst mayors. And after that, she was selected to be chair of the C40, which is a group of mayors working together against climate change. And this really allows for mayors to amplify their impact and find ways to collaborate and work together to reduce the effects of global warming.
Well, I think this is great. And there is a key takeaway maybe for us as well, for Raya, as we often focus on international leaders and international politics. And it would be great, actually, as the example of Anne Hidalgo clearly tells us, to focus also on local leaders, because local leaders can actually play an important role when it comes to, for example, climate policy, as we saw today. And with this, I would say that we can end today's episode. So thank you very much again to Alice and Brian for joining me today. This has been a great pleasure to have you here. This has been the second in a series of 6 episodes as part of the IE Raya Summer Research Program of 2025. And to our listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to check out Alice and Brian's report at rayagroup.org and to follow us on social media to receive updates on new articles and contents. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.